Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by actor, comedy writer and podcaster, Dan Mersch. Hello.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to see you.
I'm a big fan of Famous for 15 Quid.
Yeah, it's got a very different vibe from this podcast, doesn't it? Yeah. So one of the things that I love about this podcast is it's so lovely. It's like it's just really about celebrating something wonderful, whereas our podcast is more about being incredibly mean about something horrible. So it's it's really much the opposite of what you do.
I will warn listeners, it's very sweary and probably not for you if you're a fan of Eric Clapton, but
yes.
Tell us briefly what it's about.
Well, it's a panel show with myself, Paul Litchfield and Michael Legg, and what we do is basically we go through Cameo, and the game is basically really about trying to work out what people have valued themselves at on there. Cameo's if you don't know, it's like a video messaging site, so you can write to a celebrity and say, could you wish happy birthday to my nan? And they'll say, yes, certainly, for £50 or something, or whatever, depends who they are. Some of them charge thousands. It's a horrible thing.
There's one round I particularly like where you combine the cost of several lesser-known celebrities to match that of a more famous one, which is essentially dipping into the slave trading world.
I mean, really, that's what we've turned it into. Yeah, we've made it even more unpleasant than it already is, which is, I think, quite a talent.
So, tell me, how did you first discover the Beatles?
Well, my route to the Beatles was sort of oddly late, because when I was a kid, my mum and dad didn't really listen to much Beatles, but he did have Sgt. Pepper, which obviously when you're a kid, that cover just fascinates you, and there's the bits inside and you know all the cutouts and stuff. So I remember that playing, and that really sort of resonated. And then I was a teenager, I just listened to mostly sort of heavy metal and Iron Maiden and things like that. And then I went on holiday with a group of friends, and one of them brought Sgt. Pepper. And I remember at the time sort of thinking, why did you bring the Beatles out? That's an odd thing to do. Why isn't it Blur or whatever was around at the time? And they put it on, and it all came flooding back, like in the most kind of wonderful way, literally right from the beginning of the record. And it was just such a wonderful feeling. And so I got really, really into them, like lots of people did in the 90s. You know, I got really, really into them. And then I was at university, and me and a friend of mine, we went to the Barbican because the bootleg Beatles were doing a free concert in the foyer.
Lovely.
So, to be fair, they were really good. But it does mean that there are several Beatles songs that I heard for the first time by the bootleg Beatles. I remember specifically Paperback Writer they did, and I was blown away by it. I'd never heard it. I swear I'd never heard that song. And I heard it live, and it's like, it's got such a punch to it. And I was what the hell is this? This isn't the Beatles, is it? And so I had to go and hunt it out, and I couldn't work out what they were singing either. Like, is he singing Backbiter or what? What is this? So I sort of hunt around albums. Back writer. So I bought a collection of Beatles oldies. So that's probably the first proper Beatles album I bought, was a collection of Beatles oldies but goldies, because it had that on it.
Brilliant. Yeah. It's a great way in.
An odd way in, I'd say.
Well, it is. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
So the album you've picked today, well, tell us.
Right. Well, I've picked George Harrison's wonderful posthumous album, Brainwashed, his final album, which I think is a beautiful piece of work. I really do. Interestingly, both Beatles, who we've lost so far, have both released posthumous albums as their last work.
Yes.
I'd say this one I probably prefer to the other, but, you know, they've both got their merits.
Yeah. Why did you pick this one, then?
I picked this one because I really love George. Just I have such a love for George and all the things he did, you know, not just in music but with film, and he just seems such a wonderful person and funny person. And I was genuinely really upset when he died. And then this came out a year later. I remember the time he died, I was in a tribute band to the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band.
Wow.
Yeah, and we had a gig that week at the Windmill in Brixton. And so we rehearsed and worked up Wah Wah. So we did that as a tribute to George at that gig.
Oh, lovely.
Which was nice sort of be able to do. But I think we were all sort of big fans of him. But yeah, particularly, I think this album is sort of a bit of a miracle. It's because it was sort of completed after his death by his son and Jeff Lynne. And it's, I mean, we'll sort of get into it, but it seems to me to sort of encapsulate sort of everything about him. in one record, which is quite a feat. Yeah. It's a it's a very moving piece, but also just a beautiful some beautiful pop songs, beautiful guitar playing. I'm going to say beautiful a lot during this, I'm afraid.
Quite right, too. So I thought before we start, I'd do a brief timeline just to give it some context. So we go back to 1987, and George releases what sadly turned out to be his final album of new songs, Cloud Nine. 1988, rather than ride the waves of success from the previous album, George hooks up with his mates to release two Travelling Wilburys albums in 88 and 90. 1989, you've got The Best of Dark Horse, which features three new recordings, Cheer Down, Poor Little Girl, and Cockamamie Business. 91, George tours Japan. Following year, releases a live album. Anthology, obviously, takes up much of his time in the 90s. And in 1996, he produces Ravi Shankar's album, Chance of India. That year, he also sued Dennis O'Brien for fraud and negligence while he was with Handmade Films. And then in 1997, everything stopped because he was diagnosed with throat cancer. And we cut to the 30th of December, 99. George and Olivia are attacked, resulting in injuries that, according to Danny, Tom Petty and many others, were instrumental in his rapid decline. 17 months later, George had an operation to remove a cancerous growth from his lung. July 2001, he was treated for a brain tumour in Switzerland. And then, as we know, 29th of November, George sadly died in Beverly Hills at the age of 58. So that brings us to the 18th of November 2002, with the release of Brainwashed, originally titled either Portrait of a Leg End or Your Planet is Doomed, Volume 1, which is very George.
It's so George, isn't it?
It is. Brainwash was the first posthumous George Harrison album and featured songs written over a period of 14 years. Sessions for the album had taken place sporadically throughout the 90s, but after George's death, as you said, yeah, the album's finished off, overdubbed by Jeff Lynne, Danny and Jim Keltner. And according to Danny, George had left lots of notes. He was saying the blueprints were completely there for the whole album. Every song, there'd be about four guitar takes and three vocal takes, so they could pick and choose the best ones. So he left everything ready for them,
yeah,
which I find lovely.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been a sort of such an odd and probably quite positive way to deal with grief for Danny Harrison, to have this to work through with his dad's sort of complete notes. I mean, I think they stuck to the schedule even that George had worked out, I think I read. And to sort of be going in and hearing his dad's voice every day and finishing off his dad's work and trying to work out what his dad was trying to do with this song or that song. It must have been such a peculiar thing to do, but maybe quite a good way to process grief, you know, to sort of have his dad around. He seems a very together person, Danny Harrison. There's a lovely bit in that fantastic George Harrison documentary, which everybody should see. It's called Living in the Material World, directed by Martin Scorsese, which, as I said, I think next to Get Back is probably my favourite Beatles documentary of all. I think it's just fantastic. There's a lovely bit near the beginning of that where Danny Harrison's saying, I had a dream about him last night. And he says, I asked him a question. I said, where have you been? And he says, and he answered me. And he said, his answer was, here all along, or here all the time. And then he's a sort of pause, and you think, oh, he's going to say something like, you know, which I found such a great comfort or whatever. And Danny Harrison goes, which doesn't really help me at all in any way, which I think is so funny. It's like, he really seems like a very together chap. I've got a lot of time for Danny Harrison.
Oh, he's lovely, yeah. You still think of him, you know, he was just a kid when they did the concert for George.
And then he looked so like him. It was so strange to watch that. Because I don't think I'd ever seen Danny Harrison before, and I watched that concert. I was like, but there's George from 1964. Yes. How did he get here? So weird.
Paul mentions it as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, everybody else got old.
Yeah.
George remained the same.
Yeah.
But it's so lovely seeing him there. And it's just the bit at the end always gets me when they're doing See You in My Dreams. And see Eric Clapton put his arm around him and it's like, oh.
Yeah.
And for him to appear on stage with all of his uncles and George's mates must have been so hard for him.
Yeah. But maybe, you know, again, maybe a positive thing to celebrate your dad, you know, and stand up proudly sort of saying, this was my dad, he wrote that.
Give me plenty of that guitar. I've been traveling on a boat and a plane, in a car, on a bike, with a bus and a train. Traveling there, traveling here, everywhere. surprise with the spin of a wheel, with the roll of the dice. Ah, yeah, you pay a fare, and if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there.
So, side one starts with Any Road. And this is released as a single on the 12th of May 2003, later nominated at the 2004 Grammy Awards for Best Male Pop Vocal, and it lost out to, do you want to have a guess?
Oh.
2004.
Oh, I'm not going to be good at this. Oh, no, you have to tell me, I'm not going to know.
Justin Timberlake.
Oh, dear. Well, no, to be fair, the man can sing. He can sing.
He can sing.
You know, it's, the point, you know, it's not for me, but he can sing.
Yeah. So what do you think of this one?
Cracking opener. Give me plenty of that guitar. That's what a great start to the record. Give me plenty of that guitar. And which he then does. Yeah, it's a cracking opener. Like you say, he's been sitting on this song for quite a while, hasn't he? Yeah.
Yes. It's composed in 88.
88. So he's had it for over 10 years.
Yes.
I think Bob Dylan does as well. I wonder if he got the idea from Bob to write a really good song and then just not do anything with it for ages. it's a cracker. Also, I like it. I think a banjolele on it rather than a ukulele, this one.
Yes.
Which is a lovely sound. And so you don't hear it a lot in pop. It's an oft overlooked instrument. But he plays it beautifully. All on this album, I like the amount of ukulele on it, because he clearly had quite a thing for ukulele. You know that story Tom Petty tells about him going over to his house with two ukuleles? He says, you need a ukulele. And he teaches him how to play it. And then as they're leaving, he goes, I'm going to leave some more here. And George opens up his boot and he's just full of ukuleles. It's like, well, you never know when you might need one. Not everyone has them.
No.
Which I love.
I have four. Yeah.
But it's a real kicker to start the record. It's a good kicking start, I think.
Oh, it really is. And, if you buy this, a year after he died, it's going to be a weighty album to put on. And then it starts off and he's there, hey, da, 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 da. It's such a jaunty start to the album.
Oh, even like halfway through, he starts going, arriba, arriba, in the background.
Yes.
It's like, he's very good at being silly, George. I like it when silly George floats to the surface.
Yeah, that's the best, George.
Yeah.
It was written during the video for This Is Love.
Oh.
When he was in Hana in Hawaii. Island of Maui. Oh, he had a holiday property over there, and he saw a signpost with the phrase, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there.
Oh, brilliant.
Some also think it might be inspired by Chapter 6 of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, when you've got Alice and the Cheshire Cat, and it goes, would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here? That depends a good deal on where you want to get to, said the cat. I don't care much where, said Alice. Then it doesn't matter which way you go, said the cat. So long as I get somewhere, Alice added as an explanation. Oh, you're sure to do that, said the cat, if you only walk long enough. Bit tenuous, but...
No. That could be in there. Yeah. He's eclectic. That's the thing about George. He reaches from a lot of sources. But the other island in Maui, that's an awful thing as well, because he bought it, and then there was like a right-of-way thing past his house. So he launched another of his many lawsuits to get that closed down and fought it, because he was very obsessed with his privacy. And then finally, by the time that they did get it closed down, he was far too ill to go. So he never went back there. He was too ill to return there. So it was such a Pyrrhic victory. Back to this wonderful song. Yeah, it's a fantastic song. And I like also that because he's George, he can rhyme bow to God and call him sir with any road will take you there. So that's only George. Well, yeah, only someone from Liverpool could do
or
that.
Or Cilla Black.
Yeah, Cilla Black would, yeah.
I think throughout this album, I love his lyrics. It's just travelling deep beneath the waves in watery grottos and mountainous caves.
It's great, isn't it?
And it really hammers home, he's writing about Friar Park, basically.
Yeah,
what he saw all the time.
Yeah.
Basically, let's just watch Living in the Material World. But there's the scene where he wanted a hill moved and a pond swapped.
Well, he's meticulous. He's into the details.
And one thing I find was so amusing, his usage of the word the, when he's going through the space and the time, or with the thoughts in the head, rather with thoughts in my head. And it makes it sort of disembodied. It's very strange. Reminds me of the cover sleeve as well.
Yes, yeah. Which I assume was his design as well, I guess.
I think Danny...
Or did Danny come up with it?
Got involved in that, yeah. I don't know what...
I'm not entirely sure what's going on. It seems to be saying, don't watch television all the time, I think. Get out there and be in the garden, I think.
Well, I suppose it relates, to the brainwashed lyrics, maybe.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Just another couple of things I really like. It's so jaunty. The penultimate line, they use that bit of Hey Joe, where it's like... Dun, 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 dun. And the final line where he goes up an octave.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like 60s George.
Yeah.
It's so lovely.
It's really unexpected, isn't it? That's the thing about George. It's something Jeff Lynne talks about is how he always does the unexpected. Like, he'll use, like, strange chords and weird progressions. And you never really know what, like as brilliant a songwriter as McCartney is, quite often you can hear like the beginning of one of his songs, you're like, oh, I know how the rest of this is going to go. Whereas George, you can hear the first 30 seconds to a minute and you'll have no idea what he's going to do with this.
Yeah.
And I love that about him, you know.
Gaze at the ceiling from below, splendid Michelangelo. Fill my heart with delight. That's Saturday night.
So we move to track two, and it's George ripping into the Catholic Church. It's P2 Vatican Blues, brackets, Last Saturday Night, brackets.
He's not got much time for the Catholic Church, has he? Not as an ex-Catholic as he was. He really got out of there and stayed out. Yeah, he seems to be quite bothered on this record a few times about papal puffs of white smoke. They seem to come in a few times. For some reason, that's really got his goat. I don't know why. Also, I found something out about, you probably know this already, but it took me a while to work out what he said, because there's a little bit in the middle where he's about to go into the solo, and he goes, and it's really hard to hear what he's saying. I've worked it out.
Let's hear Connemara Chingers. Play it, card, baby.
He goes, oh, I've written it down. Let's hear it, Connemara Chingers, play it, card. And what that's a reference to is a man called Paul Marcinkus. This is such an obscure reference. It's Paul Marcinkus, who was a Catholic bishop and a former head of the Vatican Bank, who was investigated for money laundering and was a prime suspect in the poisoning of Pope John I in 1978. That's the sort of references you get with George. That's the sort of thing.
Well, it harks back to all those Beatles songs where Ringo's going, come on, George, play it for me one more time.
Yeah. Just sort of thrown in there. But then you're referencing this person that you have no idea who it is. Because I was trying to make it, and I thought, I'll go on, like, lyric sites. You know, someone will have it on there. And on all of them, it says, let's hear it, ... And I thought, that hasn't helped me, has it?
Well done.
So, yeah, it took a bit of hunting to work that one out. But there you go. So it's an obscure reference to a slightly disgraced former bishop.
With these songs, it's because they're recorded over a 14-year period. You've got to say, I mean, a lot of people criticise Jeff Lynne, but he's managed to make songs that are 14 years apart sound like they're all recorded together.
Yeah.
You know, you can't differentiate. You couldn't say, oh, this one's from 1988 or whatever. Definitely. It's done a really good job.
Definitely. It's a consistent thing. What do you think about him doing Free as a Bird? Did you like that?
I did at the time because it was... I love it, actually. Yeah. I'm saying I did at the time and I still do.
Yeah,
it was a new Beatles material because I remember there was a box set called Artifacts doing the rounds on the bootlegs at the time. And there was three volumes of it and there was one that did unreleased solo material.
Mm.
And I listened to all of them and the last track was Free as a Bird, John's demo.
Oh, the original demo that they worked off?
Yeah, just before they released Free as a Bird officially.
Oh, I've never heard that. Is it very different? I mean, is it...
No. Well, it is what you hear, minus all the instrumentation. And I just didn't play it because I wanted to hear, for the first time in my life, a new Beatles song.
Yeah.
And, I love it. What about you?
I'm fonder of it than most people as a song. The Jeff Lynne, I'm like, I don't know, it's very Jeff Lynne. Which, yeah, for some people, it's just what you're after. And it's a shame that George Martin, but I guess his hearing must have gone too far to be able to work on it. But absolutely my favourite bit of Free as a Bird is that George solo, where it just soars, it just takes off. That beautiful slide solo in the middle of it. That to me is like, oh, God, there we go. That's now we got a song.
There's tons of that on this album as well.
Oh, God, yeah, his guitar playing is... You can always tell it's George. You notice that?
Yeah.
Just hear George in any song, and there's a few people like that. Like, I suppose Brian May, you can always sort of think, oh, that's Brian May, or that's Jimi Hendrix. But, you know, he's one of those guitar players where you always know it's him.
Even if he's playing one note.
Yeah.
It's just...
That's a George note.
I'm sure that's, he picks it up from sitar.
Yeah.
He must be playing it in the way he plays sitar.
Yeah, maybe. But yes, this is it's sort of like a sketch, this, isn't it? It's about, you know, about him being annoyed about the Catholic Church making money, you know, out of people. Which, to be fair, if you read the Bible, that's the one time Jesus really loses his shit, is when people are making money out of the church.
Money-launderers.
Yeah. So, you know, he's sort of got a point.
Because George, like you said, he had a Catholic upbringing. And it's interesting to note his disdain for it on this record. But back in 68, he wrote a letter to his mum, because she was a devout Roman Catholic, and he wanted to reassure her about the Maharishi. And he wrote, "Dear mum, thanks for your letter last week. And if it's any comfort to you, don't worry about me, or don't think anything negative about Maharishi, because he's not phony. It's only the bullshit that's written about him that's phony. He's not taking any of our money. All he's doing is teaching us how to contact God. And it doesn't affect my dedication to Sacred Heart in any way. It only strengthens it. But we will help to spread this teaching so that everybody can attain this, and new generations will grow up and have this right from the start, instead of going through the ignorance that seems to dominate everything and everyone at the moment, causing them to feel that it's mysticism or something strange or black magic. Don't think that I've gone off my rocker, because I haven't. But I now love you and everybody else much more than ever." Which is a nice... letters sent to your mum.
Yeah, well, yeah. but you know, that was him, wasn't it? He just sort of wanted a better world. He wanted, whatever it takes. I just want, you know, it to be a better world with meaning in it.
One final thing I love about this, the final chord, which is a pure Beatle chord.
Yeah.
Rowers gliding on the river, Canadian geese crab along the bank, back wheel of my bike begins to quiver, the chain is wrapped around the crank.
Track three, with one of my favourite opening couplets, "Rowers gliding on the river, Canadian geese crap along the bank, Pisces fish."
Now you're talking. What a song. I love this. I think it's just, I've said I was going to say it a lot, it's beautiful. This is a beautiful song, I think. And also, it's you know, finally we've got to something he really likes, which is, you know, just walking along the riverbank, just watching the world go by, watching the Thames. It's again, it mentions, you see smoke coming out of the brewery like someone found the latest Pope. It's like,
yes,
just enjoy your walk. Just enjoy it. Don't be angry about everything all the time. Just have your walk. But no, it's a lovely sort of idyllic, you know, picture. But it's like a painting, really. It's, you know.
It's lovely because in June 99, George did an interview to promote Yellow Submarine song track and typically barely mentioned it at all. All he talked about was his, you know, gave us some clues about the next album, which would have been Brainwashed. Yeah, apparently at this point he was going to include a cover of Dylan's Every Grain of Sand and a song called Valentine, which he described as a potent power ballad, along with Brainwashed, Run So Far, and this one. So this goes back at least to June 1999.
Oh, wow. Was that one, Valentine? Has that come out?
I've never heard it, no.
There must still be unreleased stuff then, I guess.
Oh, there's got to be tons of stuff.
Yeah. I'm greedy. Do you like the Bob Dylan bootleg series? Go on, just have the George Harrison bootleg series. I want to hear them.
Yeah. But, yeah, some great lyrics on this. So, sometimes my life, it seems like fiction. Some of the days, it's really quite serene. I'm living proof of all life's contradictions. One half's going where the other half's just been. Yeah, we were saying before about his contradictions. He was well aware of them.
Yeah. Is it Patty talks about it in Living in the Material World? About you know, how he can just be sort of super calm and he's the most serene one day, and then he just could just blow his stack. And, you know, it must be so hard being like that. You know, like having this inner peace, this inner light, that then suddenly explodes into an inner fury.
And I guess if you're extolling these virtues to the world via the media, it's going to be really difficult to have a strop on.
Yes.
Knowing that everybody, you've been telling everybody how peaceful you are. And it's going to, you know, it's his devout faith combined with the serenity of gardening, perhaps.
Yeah.
But with his love of Formula One and extramarital affairs.
Yes, he's a fan of those.
I mean, Olivia's very gracious about that aspect.
Yeah, she is. In that film. She's like, well, yeah, we have difficulties in all marriages. The trick of a good marriage is not to break up. Successful marriage is not to break up. Then get divorced, that's it, yeah. I suppose you've got a point.
I mean, as an opener, you know, there's three tracks that are fantastic.
When it came out, you're like, oh, yeah, this is the last sort of album. This has been sort of pieced together. Yeah, there'll be some stuff on here. And then you're three songs in and going, this is the best thing he's done in years. This is the best thing he's done, probably in decades. I'd put this up there with, like, Living in the Material World. I'd say this is like, I mean, All Things Must Pass is just, that's all conquering. But I'd put this like two or three of his solo albums. I'd put it that high. I think it's fantastic. And also, I think All Things Must Pass is the best solo Beatle album. I really do. I think I find that almost unarguable. That, you know, there's some other great stuff out there, but it's just so vast. I mean, obviously, apart from the jams at the end, but it's so vast. And the material is so good. But we're not here to talk about that album, so I'll shut up. But yeah, but this is up there, you know. This is, as I say, three songs in, and it's, everything's a winner here.
And they're real growers. Again, the first time I heard this, it took two or three listens because of the way, you know, it was just after George's death. And then I didn't really listen to the lyrics. That's my problem.
Yeah.
It was just sort of, it became kind of background music. And then I sort of forgot about it. And then it was only a few years later, I thought, I must listen to that again. And it took me that long to understand it more. Yeah. And I would recommend anybody who's sort of put it on the back burner, put it on a couple of times. Each song will grow on you.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, it sticks with me.
Oh, Lord, won't you listen to me now? Oh, love, I got to get me back to you somehow. I never knew that life was lonely. I only hung forever to I never knew the things exploding. I only found it out when I was down upon my knees, looking for my life, looking for my life.
Track four, Looking for My Life.
Another cracker. It's another cracker here. It's got a great little opening guitar. And the guitar work throughout this one is just gorgeous. His, you know, his playing, as I say, across the whole album is just superb. Yeah, a beautiful song, again.
Danny, again, he was saying it was really hard emotionally to get this record done because we'd get through a session and once the song was complete, we'd be so excited, like, well, hey! And then we'd suddenly remember that, oh, and choke up and nearly cry. Yeah, and Jeff Lynne is very much on this. It's got that boom, boom timpani that he likes to put in.
Which works, to be fair, works great on this song. It sounds fantastic, that, those drums. Ba-dum. Yeah, it gives it a real urgency, I think.
And again, because it's so difficult to date some of the songs, it's difficult to ascertain what the lyrics, you know, they could be about the attack or what, or they could not. But you sing, oh boy, you've got no idea what I've been through. Oh love, I feel so stuck that I can't get to you. Had no idea that I was heading towards a state of emergency. I had no fear where I was treading. I only found it out when I was down upon my knees, looking for my life. Which are like, painful lyrics.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, obviously he wrote this when he was in one of his down periods. He was having a bit of a bleak time, which, you know, we all get. But, yeah. Also, he's bothered about not having got any GCEs on it. I never got any GCEs.
Yeah.
I think you did all right. I won't worry. Let that go.
Well, that'd be his pet, you know, in his, as a kid, he would have been expected to get a trade. I suppose he's still got that sort of mum and dad's, you know, you've got to get yourself a trade, get some qualifications.
Yeah. You can't be intelligent without qualifications.
From his 40-acre mansion.
Exactly.
In Henley. But that line, oh boy and oh love, for me, I'm just reading stuff into this, sounds like he's singing to Danny, as in oh boy and oh love, Olivia.
Oh.
Yeah, I just think he seems really insecure about, I don't know, is it his faith? It's almost like he's, like we were saying before, he didn't feel he was ready for his death that he prepared for all his life when he got that attack and he didn't get the opportunity to die on his own terms.
Yeah.
They're very difficult to ascertain what he's actually...
It's trying to sort of divine. Well, it could just be, he might have just forgotten Olivia's birthday, and so this is a sorry song.
Yeah.
You know, it could be anything. We're not going to know. It's, you know, it's just whatever we take from it, I guess. But yeah, he's sorry for something. He's done something.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, exactly. Aren't we all? We've all done something wrong.
Looking
We've all got one of these in us. Probably not quite as beautifully written, but we've all got some rights.
Every word you've uttered and every thought you've had is all inside your files, the good and the bad. But in the rising sun, you can feel your life begin. Universe at play inside your DNA.
Track 5, Rising Sun.
Are you getting tired of me saying what a cracking song this is again? Just fantastic. The slide on this, the slide throughout the album, but the slide on this particularly is right at the centre of the song. And George plays slide guitar as well as anyone ever has, I'd say. Again, some fantastic lyrics on this. The universe at play inside your DNA, you're a billion years old today. It's that sort of rising tone as well. It's such a lovely little bit, that. I love that.
This was initially introduced to Jeff Lynne, and George played it to him, surprisingly, on his ukulele.
Oh, no, really?
But, yeah. Among all the notes that he left for Danny and Jeff, the instructions he left on this one were chunky cello parts with wobble. And that's what he's got, you know. Yeah. He's got those glissando strings and that chugging cello.
With wobble?
With wobble. But I think it gives it a sound of like When We Was Fab.
Yes,
or
yeah.
Or Iron Walrus kind of film in the background.
Yeah, definitely. Da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, no, it's great. And there's some strange phrasing in it as well. There's a bit where he sings umbilical cord, because he's trying to fit it in. And he does that a couple of times on this record, where it's like, it probably was a different word you could have had in there that would have fit better. But he sort of wrenched it in, do you know what I mean? It's like a jigsaw piece that's got the wrong bit. You bang it in, it's like, oh, that fits.
Well, it's like that in Get Back, that attracts me like a pomegranate.
Yes.
It's like he hadn't quite found the world. I don't know. Yeah, maybe he hadn't finished that bit.
I guess sometimes, you know, the music here is great. I've got these lovely lyrics. They don't fit. I'll make them fit. My song, do what I like.
Another great song. I again recommend anybody who hasn't listened to it.
And his singing on it as well. His singing is... Yeah. His voice is so beautiful on this record. I must stop saying beautiful. His voice is very excellent on this record.
So, that, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a weight behind the album. Mm. It's difficult to listen. I think I listened to this album when I first heard it. It was really sad and really poignant.
Yeah.
And then after, the more you listen to it, it's like a lot of George's songs, they really grow on you, and you kind of almost forget.
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. I think if you didn't, you know, there's nothing about it, really. Because I think, I'm not sure how much of it he wrote knowing he was dying, because a lot of the songs he's had for quite a while, I think. So there isn't really a huge sense of, this is my farewell to the world. You know, not like Warren Zevon's The Wind or something like that. It's you know, this is very much a kind of, just that you could put it on and go, you wouldn't know. It's not a doomy album at all.
That's the thing, because the songs were recorded over such a long period. It's so difficult to date. We can date a few of them. Mm. But, yeah, and it adds a bit of ambiguity to the lyrics, because he could be singing about his impending death, or it could be something else. It's very difficult. Is he singing about God, or is he singing about a woman?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very George.
It's very George, yeah. He's leaving us here all puzzling. Yeah. He'd be delighted.
Well,
he is such a... I mean, we've talked about this. He is such a man of contradictions. You know, he's such a... He's very, very spiritual, but also very material. He's got this huge mansion with these gardens the size of Buckinghamshire, you know. And he's... He's calm and serene, yet also extremely pissy. You know, he can be incredibly, incredibly pissy and, you know, argumentative and stroppy. There's that bit in the Living in the Material World where they go out to a club, when they're, you know, the Beatles, they go out to a club with Jay Mansfield, and a photographer starts taking pictures.
Yeah.
And there's this one photo of George standing up and just throwing a drink at the photographer. Yeah. So we got out and left after 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So we're taking your picture. You're famous. That's what they're supposed to do. What do you think was going to happen? Well, I'll tell you, the sad, sorry, I was, the thing about Dennis O'Brien as well, when you just read out all the things he was kind of stuck doing between Cloud Nine and, you know, the reasons why he didn't do another album sooner, really. The thing about Dennis O'Brien is, it's, you know, if, you read, like, you know, Peter Doggett's book, the You Never Give Me Your Money, and it, which is all just about sort of the end of the Beatles and everything that happened after. The amount of time, let alone money, they wasted just suing each other or suing various things.
Yeah.
It's just, it's heartbreaking to read, because you think, yeah, you could have been doing so many wonderful things if you just, you know, picked up the phone and gone, sorry, that was a bit rude of me to, you know, say all those things about you on that album. Let's just do a record or something. Yeah. And it's just, you know, the longer it goes on, and now George is annoyed with Paul, now John's annoyed with George, now Ringo's annoyed with everybody. It's like, there's no one point where they go, oh, do you know what, it's all right, we're mates, you know.
Yeah.
It's such a...
There's an amazing interview with Michael Parkinson and Ringo and George, where Ringo's saying, George... did some stuff on my album, but I did a different production, so he sued me.
That's right. It's Aspel. Yeah. That's a great interview. That I really like. Because obviously he talks about, you know, like people think, oh, I'm this sort of mad recluse because I don't go to parties, I don't miss seeing around, which is something that happens to like Kate Bush and people like that as well. And you go, no, he's just enjoying being in his garden and walking up and down the Thames watching rowers. You know, he's just, yes. He wants a bit of a normal life. He's done all that, you know. He's been running around the world chased by people like in Hard Day's Night for years, you know. And he's done all the drugs. He's done all of them. There aren't any left. He's had them, you know. And now he's just like having a nice peaceful time. He doesn't really want to be paraded in front of everybody like a some sort of exhibit.
Yeah. I do love that suburban side of him, because you hear stories about him. He used to have his local pub.
Oh, really?
He used to go to. And, he recorded... Soft-Hearted Hannah, it was inspired by that. And
I think
you've got some of the background of the pub in there. But also he likes his Formula One. It's sort of like, you know, when you're a kid and you've got your granddad, you go around there and on Sunday I'll be watching the racing or whatever. Yeah. He strikes me, he's got that side to him, which I find very endearing.
Right, definitely, yeah. It seems like such a long way, doesn't it, from sort of Krishna to, you know, Monaco. It's like,
Raga Marwa, an Indian classical raga traditionally played at sunset. George posthumously won a Grammy for this song in the Best Instrumental category, and it's Marwa Blues.
Yeah. What a really inventive guitar player he is. I think this sounds a little bit Pink Floyd. I don't know what you think.
Yeah.
I think there's a touch of like almost Gilmour's guitar. I know you said you could always tell it was George, but I think there's the guitar tone on this. It's almost a bit like David Gilmour. And it's not quite Pink Floyd, but it's got like that feel to it, and it's a terrific instrumental. It sort of just takes you off, and it's actually really movingly used in, I'm going to bring up again, Living in the Material World, where it's quite near the end of the film. There's a sort of montage of shots of George, and it's coming towards the part where George is dying, and there's this montage of shots of him with this playing over it, and it's just heartbreaking. It's just the music just. It's so beautiful. And this guy made this, you know, he had this inside him and let it out into the world. And it's part of, I think, what I was saying earlier on about the whole album feeling like a kind of summation of everything that is George. So it's like, you know, he's spiritual, he's testy, he's funny, he's acerbic. And this, it's like, it's just this calmness. This is the serene George on here. You could drift away to this, you know, this piece of music. You could just sort of, if it was, you know, 3 days long, you could probably meditate to it, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, sunset sums it up perfectly, I think.
Yeah, exactly. It really feels like watching a sunset, doesn't it? I'm glad he won the Grammy for it as well. At least he got one.
It's really interesting the way this was put together, because Jeff Lynne said, when I first got it to work on, it was a complete jumble. It had five lead guitars playing at the same time, all doing different tunes. Gradually, over a period of days, after listening to every single note, we realised what it was and found the tune amongst all these extra ones where he was just noodling. And I remember Danny was over the moon because we'd finally solved the puzzle of the Marwa Blues. So it's amazingly put together. You know, this has got to be one of Jeff Lynne's best things he's ever done, I think.
Yeah. Extraordinary detective work, you know, searching through this man's many notes and where that would go, where would this go, how does that fit in, you know, because again it, like his songs are so odd, you know, a lot of the time, you know, he does unpredictable things, so he can't have meant to play that chord, can he? No he did, yeah, he's being George.
And yeah, they're very subtle chord changes, because about halfway through the diminished chords start emerging.
Yeah.
And there's little echoes of Strawberry Fields with that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's lovely, that bit, isn't it? That little descending line is lovely.
Author Simon Leng calls it the most personal and emotionally resonant guitar performance of his career. Identifies the track as a culmination of the musical and spiritual journey Harrison had begun in 1966 as a sitar student under Shankar. His playing is at once almost unbearably touching and spiritually enraptured, offering a multi-dimensional emotional experience, which I think sums it up.
Oh, definitely. He's the best guitar player in the Beatles, I think. Because I know there's the thing about Macca had to do Taxman, didn't he, because George couldn't do it. And Macca is clearly an incredibly good guitar player, but he's not George. It's, you know, George has got something else to him. I find their relationship fascinating. McCartney and George. Yeah. That whole, like, it's that thing he says in Anthology where he goes, yo, you know, he was 9 months older than me, and to this day he's still 9 months older than me.
Yeah.
And I think that really does sort of speak to quite something, because I think McCartney has always, I think he always sort of seemed to kind of put George down a bit, and him being like the junior partner in the Beatles, which, you know, I think he's such an important part of the sound of the Beatles, such an important part, not just because the songs, but the little riffs he came up with, his voice, a different kind of song that he would give them, you know. Even from Don't Bother Me, I think Don't Bother Me is great, and it sounds like nothing else on there. I love the fact also the first song he writes is like, bugger off.
Yeah.
Just leave me alone, will you? Which he continued for the rest of his life, asking people not to bother him.
Yes. One of the many benefits of all the Get Back footage is we can see George, he needs time to work on his little bits and work on his solos. So you think like Taxman or something like that, and Another Girl, Paul plays. It's, you think the Beatles at the time, they were on a really tight schedule, that everything they did had to be done immediately.
Yeah.
So it might be a case of, oh, I just need another hour or so to... No, we can't because
we've
got TV
appearance. No time, yeah. Yeah,
you know, I'm wondering if it's simple things like that, but for George, yeah, that's going to niggle.
Yeah. I mean, even after he died, the thing McCartney said was, you know, I've lost my baby brother. Not I've lost my brother, I've lost my baby brother.
Yes.
But, oh, that's a little sort of microaggression in there. Just, yeah. Although I've read somewhere that apparently McCartney did an awful lot of the press after George died so that Olivia and Danny wouldn't have to, which, if that's true, I think is just, wow, that's what a beautiful thing to do.
He said, you know, they're brothers, and they were. You know, you can insult your own brother, but won't betide anybody else who tries.
Yeah. One other thing as well, it's just a lovely moment in Living in the Material World where they have that bit of footage that isn't in the Anthology, but it's when the first time they sort of come together, George, Paul and Ringo, for the Anthology, and Paul's wearing a leather jacket, and George goes, is that a vegetarian leather jacket? It's like, it's like right from the off, he's like, I'm going to needle you.
That's the thing, isn't it? Whenever you watch Anthology, which... By the way, we might be this year, but I can say no more.
Oh, wow.
We'll leave it there. whenever you watch it, I do anyway. Whenever George and Paul are on the screen in the later interviews, I'm just looking at the dynamics between the two of them.
Yeah.
I'm mesmerised by it.
Body language is extraordinary, isn't it? So uncomfortable. Never slept so little. Never smoked so much. Lost my concentration, I could even lose my touch. Talking to myself, crying out loud. Only I can hear me now, stuck inside a cloud.
So flipping over to side two, we start with track 7, Stuck Inside a Cloud.
Well, I'm going to surprise you. It's another beautiful song, which I believe it's Danny Harrison's favourite on the record, which is why it's number 7, because George always put his favourite one at number 7.
He did. Yeah, it's very like John's number 9.
Yeah,
that's the story, isn't it? Track 7 was always where he put his favourite song. This is Danny's favourite song. But yeah, previous albums, just so you know.
Oh yeah,
notes, everybody.
You can make, make a playlist of this. This is a good playlist.
Actually,
the George Harrison number 7s.
Yeah. So you got, well, starting from All Things Must Pass, Behind That Locked Door.
Oh, gorgeous.
Living in the Material World is The Lord Loves the One That Loves the Lord.
Oh, okay.
Wouldn't have been mine.
No, I could Be Here Now.
Yes. Oh,
I'd
Be Here Now. Dark Horse is Dark Horse.
Oh, fair enough.
Extra Texture, Can't Stop Thinking About You.
Okay.
33 and a Third is True Love, which I think, didn't he sing about Patty?
Oh, okay.
And George Harrison, the self-titled album, is Dark Sweet Lady, which he wrote about Olivia.
Okay.
So it's nice.
Oh, that's, yeah.
So, Something in England is Writings on the Wall.
Right.
Gone Troppo, Unknown Delight. And Cloud Nine, Devil's Radio, which is criticising radio.
Yeah, yeah. He was happy about that. He likes having a pop at things, does our George?
But this was the first track we heard at the time, because it was released as a promo on UK and US radio stations. So I don't know if this is, of all the tracks, this would be the one that you'd push first.
No, I wouldn't say it's the most commercial, but yeah, this isn't the one that's got hit written all over it. But it is a very, very beautiful song. And it's got it's a really poignant line towards the end. Yeah, crying as we part, knowing as you leave me, I also lose my heart. When you, I don't know if he wrote this knowing he was dying, but that's such a kind of, oh God, you know, as we part, knowing as you leave me. You know, is he writing from her point of view, or is he seeing the world leaving him? I find that very poignant, that bit.
Again, the lyrics are so difficult because you can't. Although Jim Keltner said this song goes back to the 80s.
Oh right. So actually, it's not about that at all.
Well, no, because he would have. Changed his lyrics all the time, didn't he? Maybe have stuck with them. It's just impossible to know. But yeah, you can't help but think that.
Yeah.
From the perspective of, say, writing it in the 80s, it might be, I don't know, talking about holiday in Hawaii or something, you know, talking to myself, crying out loud, only I can hear me, I'm stuck inside a cloud.
Yeah.
But yeah, you place it with his illness and...
Oh, yeah. But then the guitar is very Hawaii. There's some of the guitar parts are very Hawaii. So it could be, yeah. And the singing is beautiful. And Stuck Inside a Cloud, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, this sort of soaring voice at the end there. What a singer. What an underrated singer, I might even say.
Yes, apart from Dark Horse. But
we won't go into that, But he had a dicky throat. Let's
be did.
It is terrible, though, isn't it? God. Ooh. Have you done that record yet?
No, not yet.
It's not my favourite, I must be honest.
It's not my favourite. You have to really push past that vocal
a
lot of the time.
Really rough, isn't it? Yeah.
I remember seeing Ding Dong, Ding Dong, the video of that one New Year's Eve back in the 80s, I think. I was only a kid.
Mm.
I was terrified. I saw, there's George Harrison, the one from the Beatles.
Yeah.
And then it was like, ring out the... Oh, it was like, ring out the dead.
Why is he doing that? And the footage of him singing live in the documentary at that time, it's just, God, it's like, he's howling. He's singing these beautiful songs. And what's he doing? Have a week off. I guess he couldn't.
No, he did it for us.
Yeah,
he did it for us.
You fly, how does your smile words knowing the mess you're in, you know that you can't get away, and you know that you can't hide it from yourself. Holy days, blue guitar, there's no escape.
Track 8, Run So Far.
Yes. Speaking of songs that have changed lyrics, the lyrics of this are certainly different from the Clapton version. Although musically, it's quite close.
I think this one's got more acoustic guitars
yeah.
on it.
Oh, this one's miles better, but, I'm not a huge fan of Eric Clapton. I've no idea what Jack Bruce was like, but having seen the Ginger Baker documentary, I think Cream are the band I would least like to go for a drink with. It's very threatening. I wouldn't like it at all. But no, this is, again, I love this song. But this is the first version I heard. I didn't hear the Clapton version until much later. And he sings about, which I don't think is in the Clapton version, but he sings about the blue guitar. And I was wondering, is that a reference to While My Guitar Gently Weeps? Is it blue because it's weeping? Or is it just a blue guitar?
Be, couldn't it?
Yeah, or it could have been there was a blue guitar in the room. But yeah, talking about my blue guitar makes me think, oh, he's got a sad guitar. He's gone back to that again. Now, I like the way it stops and starts this as well. I like the way it's sort of, and then I like the way the drums come out and they come back in again. I don't know what the word for that is, but I like that.
And it's that little, it's such a beautiful little riff that sort of takes me back to If I Needed Someone, where he's using the riff as the main part of the song.
With that sort of ringing tone on the guitar as well. It's just it's got bells.
Because George at the time, he'd offered Eric two other more rock orientated songs, Cheer Down and That Kind of Woman. But, let's not talk about
him. I know, it's weird that they stayed friends, isn't it, though? I wasn't there. I wasn't involved, so I can't.
I think George is very much a man's man.
Yeah.
You just wonder what George, if they were still mates now, what George would be coming out with. I think George is too intelligent.
I'd hope so. Some of that. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure this is something you talked about before, but I often have a chill worry about what John Lennon would be like if he was on Twitter now or GB News or whatever. He was an outspoken man. And I don't want to think about it.
It was somebody, I forget who it was now, was talking about if the Maharishi was still alive, would he have his own show on LBC?
I would like that. Lovely giggle there, Maharishi.
But it's like, so you've got Lonely Nights, Travelling Far, There's No Escape, Can Only Run So Far, Lonesome Tears After Dark, There's No Escape, Can Only Run So Far. Again, these lyrics are so deep.
Yeah.
It's easy with him because his songs can be so melodic and with these painful lyrics underneath.
Yeah, so that help trick, isn't it? A jolly song with a tortured lyric. Yeah, you dig into it and you go, oh, God, you're not happy. You're not in a good place at all here. But again, so this must be, like, at the time of recording, or the time of release, this must be at least, 10, 15 years old, this song? This must be an 80s.
Yeah, right? 88 it was written.
But changed, but it's, still sort of close enough. It's a cracker. They're all. That's the thing. They're all really good. This is one of those albums where they're just all really good. But that's what I'll say earlier. That's what I like about this podcast. It's easy to do like podcasts about it was a bit shit with that, wasn't it? That was a bit of a rubbish album, wasn't it? And I like the fact that this is just about celebrating something you love. It's not going isn't Two Virgins a real toe tapper? You're not doing that. But it's it's about just finding the good in it, and I love that. I love that about this. I'm a bit of a fan.
Oh, thank you very much.
I know I'll never get over you. So deep this feeling I have for you.
And then we move to track 9, Never Get Over You.
Now, we talked a little about who we think this might be about. Because we were talking, maybe was it Maureen, could it be about Patty? I think, having thought about it, I wonder if it's for Olivia, because he knows he's leaving.
Yes. Do you know what? My note said, originally I thought the title Never Get Over You was about an ex, maybe Patty or even Maureen Starkey. But it's more likely saying, my love for you will never die.
Yeah.
And you're so wonderful, I can't get over it.
Yeah.
And it's about Olivia.
Yeah.
Totally agree. Because yesterday we were saying, could it be?
Who's this about? And then that sort of hit me last night. And I put it on again. And it's not always been my favourite song on this record. But listening to it with that in mind, suddenly I was overwhelmed by it. I went, Oh God, no! It's beautiful. It's I mean, I don't know for a fact that that's what it is, but I think it must be.
Yeah.
It must be a song for Olivia saying, "I'm going to leave, but I'll never get over you, even though I won't physically be here."
Huh.
It's like, oh my goodness,
that's really moving.
Yeah.
Wow.
And again, gorgeous slide in it.
No. The phrasing, "I'll never get over you."
Yeah.
It's initially, like I say, I thought it was, that's an ex, but it's heartbreaking in that context about his wife, Olivia.
Yeah. Despite the fact that he clearly wasn't the most faithful chap, he clearly loved her a huge amount. And her talking about him is wonderful, I think. And she seems like a very together. He seems like a very together, just grounded family. They really do. They seem like have like a proper sort of normal family. It's sort of, I suppose, in a way, I'd say, you know, about Linda and Paul to some degree as well. They're sort of like really wrestling hard to have an ordinary home life.
Yeah. Well, they both had kind of similar upbringings, really, didn't they? It was very family orientated.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Whereas John had a whole different thing.
Similar with Ringo, I guess. I think he just went through his teenage years in his 40s.
God, yeah, there's chat show appearances where he's, Ringo's had a couple again. Oh, but what must it like being Ringo? What must that be like? It's just, you're in this huge band and then they've broken up. What do you do? You know, you're a great drummer, but you can't, write songs. What do you do? You do your films, you do your Thomas, you do your... But you can't, you're never going to get back to what you had with that. I mean, at least sort of Macca had like Wings and he does these huge celebratory eight-hour long shows now, But Ringo must be so... So, of course, you've got to drink. It's like, I've got all this money. I'll go to Monte Carlo and play cards and get drunk all the time. So, what else am I going to do?
Well, even in the Beatles, he was saying, between albums, he just gets so... Same thing with Keith Moon as well.
Yeah.
When The Who weren't touring, he was...
True.
Especially later and later in his life, he just got worse and worse and worse. And at least Ringo had the strength to get over that.
Yeah. We see all those whole slews of time in Get Back where he's just sitting there while they... They dick around or they sort of jab on something or they have an argument. Well, not an argument, but have a chat. But yeah, I find that interesting as well, the whole thing with Get Back where it looks like they're having such a lovely time. And all their memories of it were, we had this awful time, we were at each other's throats. And then they went to see it and they're all like, oh God, no, it was wonderful. I don't remember that at all. And part of me wonders is it about 8 hours, Get Back?
Yeah.
And with calls from something like 60 hours of tape. I'm wondering if the other 52 hours are just them slagging each other off and throwing stuff across the room. And all we've got is you just cut out the 8 hours where they were nice to each other. There's an alternate cut out there that's just horrific.
I did on the first lockdown, I think it was, because all the audio tapes are out there, I listened to the lot.
Oh, wow.
Or everything that was available at the time.
How long did that take you? There must be tons.
Well, about a week and a half, I think, at the time.
But there was nothing else to do, did we?
Going on, Dan. I would say most of it, what you see in Get Back is pretty well the stuff that wasn't released as well. They're just things like guitar tuning.
Yeah. It's oddly like watching Big Brother, isn't it? But with the Beatles. It's such a strange experience. George has been voted out.
This song, though, is one of the highlights for me. It's just knowing it's about Olivia and what a way to tell someone you're not got long left to go.
Yeah.
And what a reassuring thing must be for her to have those lyrics.
Definitely. Do you think it has a touch of something about it? There's sort of a little feel of something to it as well.
And then Learning Not to Love You off 33 and a Third, that's got a similar kind of feel. It's George, sort of smooth George.
Yeah, smooth George.
And there's some lovely three-part harmonies at the end as well, which I love.
Yeah, no, it's. I feel like I've been unfair to it in the past, and just listened to it yesterday and today. I'm like, oh, God, this is beautiful. This is a great song.
I don't want you, but I hate to lose you. You got me in between the devil and the deep blue sea. I forgive. 'Cause I can't forget you. You got me in between the devil and the deep blue sea.
Track 10, Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea.
Well, now this is just lovely, isn't it? It's like it's like a sort of mini Wilburys, I think. It's like just George and a bunch of his mates just playing for the fun of it. and just playing brilliantly. It's just a lovely little thing. Now, was this for a TV show he did this?
Yeah, it was Jules Holland. It was called Mr. Roadrunner.
Right.
In 1991, broadcast in 92, yeah.
So it's the recording from that TV show?
Yeah, and they've remixed it.
Oh, cool. Like Joe Brown's on it? And
yeah, Herbie Flowers on tuba, you see him popping away. Ray Cooper, obviously, always there. And Jules Holland obviously does his solo. Yeah, Joe Brown. It's lovely.
It's a beautiful song, isn't it? It's a lovely old standard. Literally, it's like a sort of Sunday afternoon around his house. He's got his mates, they've had lunch. We'll break out the ukulele. Go on, we'll do a round of Devil of the Deep Blue Sea. It gives you a warm feeling just to listen to it. It's just so joyous.
It's a cover of Cab Calloway's 1931 song, which was composed by Harold Arlen, who also composed such classics as Get Happy, Stormy Weather, and all of the songs from Wizard of Oz.
Oh, wow. Know,
including Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Oh, wow. So you could have done that one.
But yeah, I think it has to be said as well, the video of this, George, who never really struggled in the looks department, he looks absolutely beautiful.
It does, doesn't it?
But for me, when I hear this, which we were talking about earlier as well, it really reminds me of the concert for George when Joe Brown sings See You in My Dreams.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's got that same feel, and in the context of everything, it's just bittersweet. This is one of my favourite George ones on this album. And it's like he's skipping off into the sunset with a smile.
Yeah, this could almost have been the last track. You know, this could have been like his Morecambe and Wise step off the stage, you know.
Yeah.
But also, that video, the whole time, he's sort of got like a half smile on his face. You know, he just looks so peaceful and contented. And in some ways, you know, it's again, talking about the many different aspects of George that are in this one record. In some ways, this is almost more peaceful than Mobile Blues. It's so, you could just sit there, just let it wash over you. It's just just him and his chums having a lovely little jam. And it's gorgeous.
That's when he's at his happiest, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
There's a lot of old episodes of The Tube.
Oh, wow.
YouTube. And there's one where Jules Holland just goes to this pub. He's wandering around the pub, and in the pub, it's John Peel and George Harrison sitting next to each other. And he just does this interview while they're drinking a pipe.
Just sitting there having a pipe.
But George looks so calm and natural. That's obviously his thing. He loves being surrounded by his friends.
Yeah, yeah.
And friends that he knows he needs to be able to trust.
Definitely. There's a bit of footage in the documentary where we get to talk about the Wilburys bit, and it's like a home video camera going into the kitchen. And in the kitchen is George, Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne and Bob Dylan just playing their instruments at the kitchen table. And it's like there's a party going on, you know, or something, and they've just taken themselves off to the kitchen and go, oh, there's a couple of songs in here. Imagine being in that kitchen for that gig. What? As you know, I nearly did the Wilburys album. Him just playing with his chums just makes such a great sound. Contented George. I like Contented George.
I'm going down to the river, gonna take me my rocking chair. Going down to the river, gonna take me my rocking chair. And if the blues don't leave, gonna rock all the way from here.
Next, a song that goes back to 1970, it's Rocking Chair in Hawaii.
Now, I don't know why, I always forget this is here. Because in my head, the album goes Devil of the Deep Blue Sea, Brainwashed. I always forget that this song sort of comes in.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It's you know, it's got a lovely riff played on a dobro. Nice sound of dobro in there. Nice bit of dobro sound. And it just feels like a very happy song. The idea of a rocking chair. Imagine he liked being in a rocking chair in Hawaii. Why not? You know, obviously, when people are walking past, that lawsuit is still hanging on to stop people walking past his house. But he wishes he could be in a rocking chair in Hawaii once the lawyers have cleared that up.
But like I say, this goes back to 1970. We can see, or we can hear, George playing this during the All Things Must Pass sessions. And it's interesting comparing that version to this one. Because on the original, I'm not going to do it, but he does a proper yodel.
Oh, really?
Yodel-ay! I did do it. And, but on this one, he's much softer. And it's, I'm guessing it must be recorded late in his life. His voice is very, couldn't achieve that. But
yeah,
that adds a bit of charm to it as well.
Yeah, but it's such a happy, positive little song. There's so much positivity on this record, bearing in mind what he was going through. It's extraordinary.
There's a podcast called Talk More Talk, and they highlighted the similarity between this and Hank Williams' 1950 song Long Gone Lonesome Blues.
Oh.
And then I'll play a clip of that.
Oh, good. Yeah. Yes, they are similar, aren't they, Chris?
I went down to the river to watch the fish swim by. But I got to the river so lonesome I wanted to die. Oh Lord. And then I jumped in the river, but the doggone river was dry. She's long gone, and now I'm lonesome blue.
Brainwashed in our childhood, brainwashed by the school, brainwashed by our teachers, and brainwashed by all the rules, brainwashed by our leaders, by our kings and queens, brainwashed in the open and brainwashed behind the scenes.
God, God, God.
Our voice cries in the wilderness.
God, God, God.
It was on the longest night.
God, God, God.
An eternity of darkness.
God, God, God.
Someone turned out the spiritual light.
And we end the album with Ranty George, It's Brainwashed.
It's Brainwashed, title track, yes. Yeah, it's probably the closest the album gets to a rock song. It's a great riff, I think. Slightly clunky lyrics, I think, if I'm honest. It's one of his hectoring ones. And I'm never the keenest on those. But yeah, so it's all the things you're brainwashed by. TV and the various things around you. And there's some odd phrasing again in this one to get the words in. A word is phrased very oddly to get it in before the end of the line or to stretch it across the line. But I like it. I still like it very much. It's a nice big ending. What we find out is Grandma was working for the mob during it. That's a surprise.
Yeah.
That's a surprising turn of events. Yeah. I'm not sure the mob would be happy, you know, with that information getting out, but
yeah.
Yeah, it's an odd one. I very much like the bit of the God, God, God on the chorus. It's so dramatic, like the bum, bum, bum. It is a really sort of big finish, I think.
And I think it encompasses everything about George, because he's moaning about money, like brainwashed by the Nikkei, brainwashed by Dow Jones, brainwashed by the FTSE, NASDAQ and Secure. Like, so he's still angry about money.
It's always money with George, isn't it? It's always money, from Taxman right through to the, you know, being sued for that, my sweet lord. And it's always the money bothers George. So strange, isn't it? Don't you think it's so strange?
In the 60s, I mean, it was difficult. John and Paul were earning a hell of a lot more than he was.
That is true, And also, Paul was getting more of a share of Beatle things later on, which they then sort of found out because he had some preferential deal. That can't have been nice. That can't have been a happy day, can it? You were going to tell us about this? No, I don't think I was, you know.
And it's his conflicted love-hate relationship with the material world.
Mm.
But he's always taking solace in God.
Yeah.
God, 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 wish that you brainwash us too. But there's also, there's a bit of prophetic lyrics in here. Brainwashed by the media, you're brainwashed by the press, brainwashed by computers, brainwashed by mobile phones, which turns out, to be...
He's not wrong. Go sit anywhere. It's so odd now that it struck me the other day. I was at a casting, and there were like five or six actors sat around. And when I sort of started out, you'd just be chatting to each other in the room, and everyone's just staring at this sort of thing in their hand.
Was it a mobile phone?
Hey, you've got to make an impression somehow. It's they all look at their phones, and it's you think like 30 years ago, if you saw that, it does look like brainwashing. You know, everywhere you go, you're in a pub or whatever, there's two people sat and they're both looking at a phone rather than... I'm not being that guy. I'm not being like, get off your bloody phones and start talking. I'm not being that. But it is, when you sort of stop and look at it, he's got a point.
Yes. And another thing that Stephen Price is on before has pointed out, he loves the little bit, you get Jeff Lynne every now going, brainwashed. And you can hear him popping in, which I find quite sweet.
Like he's just opened the door to lean in. And go,
yeah.
Brainwashed.
The soul does not love, it is love itself. It does not exist, it is existence itself. It does not know, it is knowledge itself. How to know God, page 130.
And also we get Isabella reading from How to Know God, specifically page 130, thanks.
Yes.
She tells us the page number. But that's an odd mystery, isn't it? We don't know who she is.
Well, yeah, because she reads, the soul does not love, it is love itself. It does not exist, it is existence itself. It does not know, it's knowledge itself. Yeah, page 130. But yeah, we've Isabella Borchimowska. I don't know if I pronounced that right.
Sounds good.
But yeah, between us, we were trying to find out who she was and why she's chosen to read this piece.
We got nowhere, did we?
We got nowhere. All I've got is she's Polish. She lived and studied in Warsaw. And she studied the piano at the conservatoire.
That's quite a lot. You found out quite a lot there. Did you pay a detective for this?
That was someone on some forum who knew her.
Oh,
and
right.
They said, oh, what happened after that is, oh, we lost contact.
Oh, God. So, well, if anybody out there knows Isabella, do write in.
Yeah. I'm sure I read somewhere that she lives in Henley.
Oh.
So
maybe it's just somebody he meets on the Thames. Park. Maybe just having a wander by the Thames, watching his rowers and his geese crapping, and he bumps into her. Yeah. You've got a lovely voice. Do you want to come and speak on an album?
Yeah,
maybe.
Oh, I'd love to know. But I reckon she's something to do. Maybe she worked at Friar Park, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Good afternoon and welcome to the BBC's news at 1 o'clock. The former Beatle George Harrison has lost his five-year fight with cancer. He died last night at the age of 58 at the home of friends in Los Angeles. His wife and son were at his bedside. In a statement, the family said, he left this world as he lived in it, conscious of God, fearless of death, and at peace.
He's such a brave lad. To me, he's just my little baby brother. We grew up together, and I knew him in my old hometown, Liverpool. And we just had so many beautiful times together that's what I'm going to remember him by. Lovely guy, he's full of humour, as I say, even when I saw him last time and he was obviously very unwell. He was still cracking jokes, like he always was. And he'll be sorely missed. He's a beautiful man and the world will miss him.
The last weeks of George's life, he was in Switzerland and I went to see him and he was very ill. And he, you know, he could only lay down. And while he was being ill and I'd come to see him, I was going to Boston because my daughter had a brain tumor, and I said, well, you know, I've got to go to Boston. And he goes, it's the last words I heard him say, actually. And he said, do you want me to come with you? Oh, God. So, you know, that's the incredible side of George.
And also it ends with the Namah Parvati, which I think is such a beautiful touch on this record.
Yes.
The last thing on his last album is him delivering this devotion to God. Like, his whole life was about this and preparing himself and chanting. And he says goodbye with this devotion. It's like, I'm not a religious man, but it's, you know, it's clearly it was such an important thing to him. And it's, and again, it's, you know, like you say, this song has got all parts of George in it, and then right at the end there's the Eastern mystic George. Although he didn't like the word mystic, but he didn't like mysticism used.
No.
But there's this Eastern devotional, and it's a lovely way to end it. I think the most appropriate way to end it.
Yes, yeah. It's amazing. It's like a requiem almost. It just emerges and then suddenly you're like, oh, bloody hell. You know, he wasn't joking when he said he loved it, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people talking about appropriation a few years ago, wasn't it? But you know, you could never say that about George. That was his whole life.
Yeah. I mean, do we know? Was that in his instructions, or was that something that Danny added, or Jeff Lynne added?
Well, it's George chanting, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think it's George and Danny.
I wonder if it was like a separate thing that they went, oh, we'll put that on the end of Brainwashed, and that'd be a great way to end the movie. I don't know.
I think from, they said they put all the clues together, didn't they? It couldn't have ended in any other way, really.
No. It's a beautiful piece of the end. But yes. But he was for someone who was so into their privacy, and privacy was so important to them. That intruder stabbing him, it just makes it all the worse, that it's like it's almost something he was expecting, and then, you know, I guess since John, you know, and it breaks my heart, it really does, because, you know, it's, he just seems the least prepared to deal with something like that. Yeah,
he mentioned that as well, didn't he, about the fact that the thing he was angry about John's death was that he hadn't had time to prepare spiritually for that moment.
Yeah.
And I think he felt the same way when it happened, because he thought he was going to die.
Yeah.
You don't really want to, but I mean, there's in Eric Idle's book, it's covered very, very much in detail.
Oh, really?
I think, yeah, and it's just horrible. Yeah. They really played it down.
They did. I remember at the time thinking, oh, God, yeah, because it sounded like he just like had a scratch or something, and he was properly worked over. I mean, oh, it's horrible. Yeah, just horrible. Yeah.
When he died, and he was surrounded by Olivia, Danny, and Ravi Shankar, and Ravi Shankar's wife, and there were some Hare Krishna people there as well, and they were all chanting verses from the Bhagavad Gita, so it's kind of got reminiscence of that.
Mm.
Very difficult to listen to, actually, I think.
So. Oh, yeah.
I think before we end, there's one omission which I think they really should have put on, was Horse to the Water.
Horse to Water, yeah.
Which was the last thing he recorded.
Yeah, I don't know why that's not on there. Was it because it had already been released, maybe? They thought, oh, well, that's already out there.
I don't know. Yeah, possibly. And also, I think because of the vinyl, it wouldn't have fit on.
Yeah.
It just seems a very strange omission.
Yeah.
It was recorded, you know, like 8 weeks before he died.
That's actually the last thing he recorded, right?
Mm.
It's a cracker, yeah.
Yeah, I guess the track listing, the more you look at it, it's perfect, isn't it? It's really.
Yeah, I suppose it's, where would you put it? I mean, if there was one song I'd swap out, I'd say probably Rocking Chair in Hawaii might be the one I'd swap out.
Yeah.
But that's nitpicking, I'd say. Well, I can only apologise for the ridiculous number of times I've said the word beautiful on this podcast, but it's, I can't think of a better word to describe this album. It's just such a great way to say goodbye, you know. I'd say, you know, and like Milk and Honey has got Grow Old With Me at the end, which is such an extraordinary thing on there. But a lot of that album, I can take or leave, if you're honest with you. But whereas this it's not a bad thing on it, you know. It's just great. I honestly would say his best album since the 70s.
So what does this album mean to you?
Well, it means, like you say, like a summation of this incredible man's life. It's, yeah, you know, we didn't even talk about like handmade films and what he did. Like, you know, it was such a great thing to give to the British film industry. You know, Python and Time Bandits, Long Good Friday, Private Function. You know, just the amount of with Nail Now, you know, the amount of wonderful films that came out of that film company. And it's such a shame that ended the way it did. But he just seemed to have love for so many things. And he sort of seemed to, like we said, sort of shoot off in so many different directions and be this constantly inquisitive, interested man who, despite suing people quite a lot, really didn't have time for all that. There's a bit in the documentary, again, where he's signing the papers to finally dissolve the Beatles, and he's chanting to himself, going, Lord, let this finally be done, and chanting. It's like, you know, he's, every fibre of his being doesn't want to be there in this place of business, you know. But, you know, he's just about creativity and spirituality, and also he's a very funny man. You know, he's, yeah, like wanted to call it Portrait of a Legend, and the cover being a picture of a foot. You know, it's, yeah, he's just a wonderful man, and I think it's a wonderful final statement to the world. As he heads off on his way to who knows where.
Dan Mersch, thank you so much.
That was lovely, mate. Thank you for that. I enjoyed that immensely.